they drop, 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 good they go. Yellow wraparound, go watch us that never show.
Welcome to the Rocks Back Pages podcast and the first episode of 2023. I'm Barney Hoskins and I'm online with my colleagues Mark Pringle.
Hi, Barney.
And Jasper Morrison Bowie.
Hello, Barney.
And joining us today, all the way from LA, is the truly legendary Pamela De Bars. Hi, Pamela.
Hi, Barney.
The sometime Miss Pamela needs no introduction from me. Her classic 1987 memoir, I'm With the Band, was a bestseller, and she's followed it up with several more books. She also has her own delightful podcast, Pamela De Bars' Pajama Party, which happens to be on Pantheon, the same podcast network as this one. Hey. Pamela, we're going to talk to you. Shout out to Pantheon. Pamela, we're going to talk in this episode about the all-gold GTOs and about lots of other things. Frank Zappa, Lowell George, Alice Cooper, and of course, the whole groupie phenomenon in your native Los Angeles. We'll also hear clips from an audio interview with producer Peter Asher. And we will, of course, pay tribute to the great Jeff Beck. It's actually a little known fact that Jeff, I think, actually performed on, played on, played some role on 1969's Permanent Damage, the only album the GTO has ever released. So can we get straight into the story of that remarkable group of women semi-assembled by Mr. Zappa? How did you, Pamela, intersect with Frank Zappa's sort of Laurel Canyon world in the first place?
Laurel Canyon was where everybody wanted to be because all the bands lived there. Love, Buffalo Springfield, The Doors, The Byrds, you know. And I knew where every one of them lived. I was very young. You know, I was 16 when I got nuts about all these bands, local bands. I was a Beatle freak, of course, but then all of it, there were local bands. And the way it happened is very strange. A good friend of mine, Victor Hayden, who later became the Mascara Snake in his cousin's band, Captain Beefheart Magic Band, yeah. He took me to meet his cousin in 1965 when I was still in high school. And so I met Don Van Vliet very early on, which changed my brain cells immediately. And I went on a whole other path. So I was in Hollywood. It took me from the Valley to Hollywood, and I started just carousing out in Hollywood. And I eventually met all kinds of like-minded girls who loved music and long-haired boys, and we just started hanging out together at a fellow's place. His name was Vito. He was a wild man, artist, dancer, freak. You know, he and his people epitomized freaks. So we danced. My girls and I danced with Vito and Carl Franzoni, who called himself Captain F. And we were just a bunch of freaky girls, you know. And so Frank Zappa moved from New York to Laurel Canyon, and he became sort of like the prince, the crown prince of Laurel Canyon. He was the weirdest person there, and no one would have imagined at that time, but he was a total teetotaler and didn't take any drugs. And one of the girls, Miss Christine, was the Moon Zappa's governess. Moon was 6 months old when I met her. We're still very close today. So we got invited up to Frank Zappa's house, all these crazy wild girls. And at that point, we were dancing with a few bands, Three Dog Night and Love and various bands that they'd invite us up on stage because we were really half naked, wild, crazy teenage girls. So that's how I met Frank Zappa. And we started spending a lot of time up there. I got very close with Gail Zappa. I always adored the women around the men. They were equally important to me because I wanted to be one of them. And so we just spent a lot of time up at the cabin, log cabin. Frank Zappa rented this crazy cabin built in 1921 or something. A cowboy, Tom Mix, built it, a movie cowboy. And the GTOs were formed in there. We were at that point called the Laurel Canyon Ballet Company. We called ourselves that, because we danced all over the place with all kinds of bands. We started dancing with the mothers, of course, on stage with the mothers. So Frank got a label. He got his own label, Bizarre Straight. And he thought we were so interesting and so clever and so funny and so amusing and so of the moment that he wanted to capture us on vinyl. So that's how that happened. He said, you guys, please write some songs about your life experiences while I'm on the road with the mothers. I'll come back and we'll do a record. And it was just unbelievable. At the same time, he christened us Girls Together outrageously. He thought that was better than the Laurel Canyon Ballet Company.
and it was.
GTOs, and we shortened it to the GTOs and added, you know, overtly, organically, outwardly, opinionatedly, whatever. The O could stand for anything we wanted it to. And that's how we all got together.
We have a review of Permanent Damage from International Times here. This was written by Miles, the legendary Barry Miles, who had the bookshop that John Lennon met Yoko in. Okay. And he was a writer also. Anyway, he reviewed Permanent Damage. He said, it is more truthful than 90% of the albums in your local record store. It is produced by Frank Zappa and it tells it like it really is. And for most people, that's incredibly hard to take. It's a wonderful album. We've been listening to it the last couple of days. Actually, it sounds great. I mean, it's an absolute hoot, both musically and, shall we say, culturally. I mean, it's very funny. There may be some things on it. Is there anything on it that would sort of make you slightly, you know, given how long ago it is, would make you feel slightly cringe, like the Cones?
Yeah, the bit. Cones. Yes. The Cones is the only one, but only because it's so close to the awful word coons, but it has nothing to do with that. It was the shape of their hairstyle. Was like an ice cream cone coming out of their foreheads. And that's the only, you know, bummer in it. And people would imagine that it was the wrong word. It's not. It was the shape of it. And we admired them. It wasn't, you know, they weren't our type. We wanted long-haired rockers, but we admired them and their persistence and all of that. And that's what that song is about. And it's funny, you know.
It is funny.
Imitate them exactly what they would say to us. They called us Snow White, you know, and they were trying to get with us, but it wasn't working. That's all that's about. And the rest of it, no. I mean, the Moke Monster review, you know, was very early talking about how men were basically abusing people, early on. But at that time, there was no recourse. There was no to anything. You know, you just dealt with it. I mean, every woman in my age has had many Me Too moments. You know, nothing new.
No, absolutely. I mean, lots of people over the years have kind of said the GTOs were so influential. There's, you know, you can trace a sort of line through all kinds of, you know, all-girl bands or entities. Probably right up to the Spice Girls, you know. You were like the original Spice Girls.
We were the original all-girl, freaky girl band.
Yeah.
There was a band, the only other band at the time of the girl was Fanny. But they were more straightforward rock and roll girls, you know, with bell bottoms and stuff. We were crazy, maniac girls. And part of it had to do with wanting to have Frank Zappa think we were great. You know, he was so important to all of us that it was like, okay, we got to make him laugh. We got to make him love us, you know. And it was nothing to do with sex with him ever. I mean, you know, Gail was someone we adored as well. But it was more about impressing him. And he wanted to capture these moments in time. And that's how the GTOs came about. He really thought this was important stuff, this teenage girl stuff at this time. And he wanted to claim it, own it, put it out for posterity, really. That's what he was interested in, I think. And the fun of it all. I mean, we had a lot of fun.
I was watching a clip of you talking earlier in a documentary about him where you said that he would conduct you with a baton, which is such a great image of Frank Zappa conducting this wild record, but holding a baton.
Lil George was a big part of our record. Because frankly, Lowell was second in command in the studio. This was before Frank realized what a pothead he was and fired him. But we loved Lowell too. He kept some sort of normalcy, believe it or not, in the studio.
He's never been accused of that before. revisiting I Have a Paintbrush, that track, I mean, it just it sounds like Little Feet before Little Feet ever made a record. I was astonished by that. And obviously his slide guitar playing on Permanent Damage is wonderful too.
Yes. People don't actually pay much attention to the musicality of that record, but there's some pretty good stuff on there.
There is great music on there. I mean, all the sort of, you know, the chatter between all of you is brilliant. It's really funny and wonderful satire and all of that. But it has some great musical moments, I would say. I mean, it's not so different. You could almost compare it to We're Only in It for the Money in terms of the sort of variety of things on the record and the conversation and so forth.
Well, Frank was making fun of stuff on We're Only in It for the Money. We were not. We didn't know we were doing a satire.
With Rodney.
We were just living, you know, and enjoying every second of it. At that time, I knew how important these moments were and how I would reflect on them for the rest of my life and how, you know, I was in the right place at the right time and all of that stuff.
There's a piece that we've added also about Miss Christine that a guy called Eric Himmelsbach wrote in 2018. And she actually mentions the fact that Miss Christine was the original like nanny for Moon Unit, wasn't she? I believe it.
Yes.
But he talks to Alice Cooper and he says that he used to come around and also help babysit Zappa's kids. It's the idea
of the whole band the time. The whole Beefheart band was there all the time.
Yeah.
I remember once walking in and the whole entire Beefheart band was sitting there. They were very unusual. They would sit there very calmly and stare into space. And the whole Alice Cooper band was there and a whole bunch of the mothers were there and a bunch of freaks too. The doors were always open there. And that's why when Gail became pregnant again with Dweezil, she said, I am not going to live like this. You have to get me a house where people can't just walk in and, you know, do whatever they want. So that's how that happened.
Wonderful. Yeah. You also knew Gram Parsons, didn't you? And of course, Christine's Tune, which was the first track on the Gilded Palace of Sin, was about Miss Christine.
No, it wasn't.
Oh, it wasn't about Miss Christine.
No, even,
it wasn't about
even Bob Dylan got that wrong on his show. Remember when he...
Oh, my gosh. Well, I'm in good company then.
Well, Miss Christine did not go out with any... You know, it was about a girl named Christine Hinton who dated David Crosby.
The Crosby.
Yeah. And she was one of those girls who was a real... She wanted to play guys against each other and different members of the Burritos and Birds and all that. And they didn't like it. Then they wrote a song about her, a pretty rude song. And I actually double dated when I was seeing Brandon DeWilde, the actor, who was very close with Graham and had a lot to do with his country music, you know, love. I was dating Brandon and we double dated with David and Christine Hinton. I remember it very well. It was a strange double date. But anyway, she died soon after that.
Yeah, she was killed in a terrible car crash.
So you know who she is too. So that's who it is.
Yeah. Because Crosby writes a lot about her in his autobiography, and it was a very tragic moment in his life. Yeah.
I'm going to read that because everyone gets that wrong because Miss Christine was much more well known at that time.
Well, I'm glad we cleared that up. I just wanted to ask you all this time later how you look back, what perspective you now have on the whole groupie phenomenon and what that word means to you now and, you know, what it subsequently meant in the era of Rodney's disco and so forth. So, I mean, what is your take on it now, Pamela, these decades later?
Well, it's changed a lot. It has, you know, at the time I was never underage. First of all, let's just go there. Okay. Mm-hmm. I was never underage when I was seeing these rock stars, but in the early 70s, the girls got younger and younger. Rodney's English Disco, you know, you could be any age and go in there. So these little baby girls, you know, started showing up. I was in my early 20s. And they were something brand new to these guys. little girls, you know, wow, here they come, all these little babies in their high heels and their shorts and stuff. So of course they wanted them there. So the girls wanted to be there. It's not like these guys were taking advantage of these girls. However, at that age, yes, it could be perceived that way. But sure. Unless you were there and saw how much these girls wanted to be with these guys and put themselves in every kind of situation so they could be with them and meet them and hang out with them, it's hard to understand how different it was, you know, how that came about. And it was a short-lived phenomenon, I think. Couldn't have happened in any other time frame.
Or in any other city, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. Although I know, you know, I had girlfriends in New York.
Yeah.
Mel Overman, who's in my book, Let's Spend the Night Together, Patty Darbinville. All these girls were, you know, like Michelle was with Steven Tyler when she was 15. And he was only like 19, you know. It's just what was happening. It's the way it was back then. And no one seems to be able to understand that. And luckily, I had nothing to do with it. I was 19 when I finally got laid. So thank God, I don't ever have to explain my way out of that stuff.
I mean, do you think that rock and roll will ever have its true sort of Me Too reckoning moment like the movie industry?
Well, some girls after Steven Tyler right now.
Yeah.
Yes. It was interesting to know what your memories of the reaction to I'm With the Band when it came out. It was a huge bestseller. It's a wonderful book. There's so much great stuff in it. How do you remember the response to it? You know, being on chat shows and getting somewhat,
I was stunned by the reaction. I just, you know, you write something. It started because I did a couple interviews. I did an interview with Stephen Davis for Hammer of the Gods, and which was one of the very first big rock book. That and No One Here Gets Out Alive, who Danny Sugarman was a good friend of mine. But Stephen Davis said, you know, wow, you know, you've got a book in here. You have your own book to write. So he was very influential in helping me make the decision to write it. I'd thought about it my whole life because I'd kept diaries and had amazing memories that I knew no one else had. So I finally decided to write it. I got many rejections. I saved them all. I saved all the rejections from publishers. And one of them said, I think it was Random House, this will never be a book. It might be an article for Rolling Stone. It'll never be a book. So I saved it. And when I got on the bestseller list, I sent it to the guy. I cut it out and sent it to him.
Yeah. I love that. That's beautifully petty. Yeah. But excellent.
You and J.K. Rowling, right?
Oh God, don't align me with her. I'm a very open.
Okay, sorry, no, I wouldn't mean to.
Open-hearted, accepting soul. You know, we had the BTOs with us, Boys Together Outrageously, and that was a time. Mm. That was a time period where anything went. You know, it was. We had the birth control pill. Boys and girls could do whatever they wanted with each other and everyone else. I mean, it was such a magical time. No wonder people are still clamoring to hear about it because it was brief. And the music being made to reflect the lifestyle of all this or vice versa, you know, it impossible to replicate, even though I've been saying lately, you know, the biggest bands in the world are going to be cover bands in the future because there's no one as good. I'm just sorry. There's no one as innovative as Frank Zappa right now. Can you think of someone? I mean,
Jasper's looking skeptical over there.
I mean, I would disagree with that. But what I really love about I'm With the Band, I'd never read it before and I started reading it in the run up to this, is that the positivity with which you talk about your own desires and just your enthusiasm for the situations that you're in, I mean, must have been in 1987 a totally revolutionary way to write about women's sexuality in a way that hadn't really been in open conversation before. I mean, now we're starting to talk more about that kind of thing in a more open way. But at that point, it must have just been like, you know, who was writing like that?
No one.
In 1987?
And I got a lot of shit for it.
I bet you did.
Yeah, I'm sure you did.
Now,
but it's brilliant.
If you read it back, it's very tame compared to some girls who decided to tell all long after I did.
Yeah.
And for me, it was all about love. I was looking for love. I wanted love, you know. That was my – I wanted that. But I wanted it in this world. So, yes, I wrote about my sexuality. I guess an ASNN maybe with the one before.
Yeah, I was going to say.
But I mean, no one during my time period would do that, especially in the 80s, I think. The 80s, like I said, 20 years earlier, it was a whole different reality. And that, and even in the 80s, it was shocking to people to read about stuff that happened 20 years earlier. And now 50 years later, it's very different. It's very different. It's like a fantasy. It's like mythology. Jim Morrison will always be that beautiful Adonis with the beads around his neck. And of course, I saw him in the gutter.
Yeah, yeah.
A fat guy with a beard in the gutter, you know. So, but I've got some good stories about him in that book. Because I was just part of, I was in this world. I was on the Sunset Strip every night of my life. The Whiskey a Go-Go was my living room, basically. So I just saw it all, and I wrote about it, and I kept the diaries, and I was able to quote myself. I was able to quote, like, oh, Led Zeppelin's doing their encore. I'm in the limo. Jimmy, oh, here's Jimmy. Oh, yeah. I mean, it was so amazing. It
took me a beat to realize that those were actual diary extracts from, you know, when you, that it's, it, you know, they're so archetypal diary entries. It's,
yes.
It's wonderful.
Yes, every young girl can relate to it even now. Of course. And I didn't mean to say there's no great music being made now. I go see live music all the time. But that particular time frame produced something in the atmosphere in that 5-6 year period that allowed this, all these geniuses to come through. It started, Elvis started it. I don't care what anyone says. And he opened these doors. And, you know, John Lennon walked through it. I mean, that's just, it's just, it can't be compared. I'm not comparing it. Can't be compared, but because there, you know, I love the Struts. I love Måneskin. There's a lot of stuff I like, but I'm glad I lived then. I'm glad I was a young girl back then.
Yes. Yes. I bet. I mean, the thing is that music was so central to the entire culture.
Yes.
In a way that is impossible to be now. It's too diverse. There's too much other stuff, you know.
Yes.
But I mean, you know, I was 12 in 1968 and I just wanted to be part of all of that, you know. It was, there was nothing else. There was literally nothing else to look at.
Yeah, I know. It permeated the whole world.
Yeah.
The Beatles, the Stones, Zepp, you know, these people permeated the universe. It wasn't like small bits of stuff like it is now. I mean, it's just, there are huge, and luckily it's a lot of women, obviously, making a whole lot of noise right now. But back then it was just, it was cultural, like you said, it was a movement, right?
Yeah.
There's no movement right now. There's a lot of different variations on that theme. But,
yeah.
And a lot of it had to do with peace and love. And that's why people look back at this like, you know, what was a love-in like? It's impossible to describe. The Doors, the Birds, whoever, they would play them for free. You know, they didn't wait around for the paycheck. It was not about that. It had so much to do with acceptance of each other.
Yeah.
I mean, it really was. Life was a love-in for a while there.
Yeah. I mean, you have written about the darker side of the kind of rock and roll dream, of course, and not all the GTOs, you know, have ended up in as good shape as you have. I mean, you always had this very sunny, upbeat disposition, I think, and that comes across in pieces about the GTOs and so forth. A couple of the other pieces that we're going to feature on the homepage are about Miss Christine and about Mercy. I hadn't realized till I revisited this piece about Christine that I mentioned earlier by Eric Himmelsbach that it was actually Jonathan Richman who basically saw Christine sort of like lying on the floor and like came in. I think one of his fellow modern lovers was having a shower, and Jonathan Richman comes. There's something wrong with Christine. There's something not right, and she had obviously overdosed. I had no idea that it was in that house in Massachusetts. And then the other piece is by our friend Chris Campion, who's an RBP writer and he's been on the podcast. And he wrote this really lovely piece about Mercy, Miss Mercy, last year, which is great. So I think he wrote it for the LA Times. And fortunately, she did have a happy-ish ending to her life, didn't she? Having been virtually homeless. And were you in touch with her?
Oh my God, she was my best friend.
She was your best friend. She was on your podcast, wasn't she?
Oh, yeah, a couple twice. Of times.
Yes. Wonderful. I'm going to have to listen to those.
Oh, my God. Have you read her book?
No, I haven't. Oh, and that's called Permanent Damage, right?
Yes, it's called Permanent Damage. She's the one who named our album.
Yes.
There's no one like her in this world. And yes, she had a rough time, but she doesn't look at her rough time of being homeless for 7 years as a rough time. She always, I can't say enjoyed, but respected her life. You know, respected no matter what she did with her life, she respected herself and what she'd been through. And
yes. Boy,
what a character. You've got to read her book. And please,
okay, we'll do
podcast. But she turned out fine. She was many, many years sober. It came about because my mother was ill and she had just gotten sober, like literally 2-3 months before. And I needed help with my mom because she was living with me and I needed some help. And Mercy always got along with her. So Mercy became her caretaker, so to speak, 3 days a week and turned her completely around because she had to be sober to do that. And she kept sober and she stayed sober the whole time ever since. So
I think Chris says she got sober on Thanksgiving Day in 1998. So she had many, many years drug free, which is really good to know. Just one quick footnote question. The featured writer on the homepage is an LA kind of mainstay, Richard Cromelin, whose name you will know, wrote for many years for the LA Times. Yeah. And we've got this piece, this review of the Hollywood Street Revival and Trash Dance in the fall of 74 at the Hollywood Palladium.
Yes.
And you're on the bill there. Were you in the GTOs at that gig?
I had just met Michael, the fellow I married, got the beautiful
last name. Yes, Michael Debars, yeah, yeah, great man.
The S is silent, by the way, it's Debar.
Debar.
Yeah. And he was performing, he had just gone solo, Silverhead, his band broke up, and he was going solo, and he was going to perform. So the GTOs got back together. We hadn't been, and it was really only Mercy, Cinderella, and me, and a couple other girls we brought up there with us, and we backed Michael.
Okay.
We backed him up and we sang, I think, oh God, Mr. Sandman. I think we sang in a really terrible way, but we enjoyed it. I remember Mercy was on heroin that night and she stumbled in late with a giant rainbow colored wig on. It was all askew and everything. So it was really quite a night. Yeah. I remember it very well.
Well, Cromelin says it was a kind of wake for the glitter rock era. And I love, again, only in Hollywood, right? But I wish I'd been there.
The
New York Dolls were headlining and Iggy Pop performed. Yeah, it sounds like fun.
It was wild. It was absolutely wild. It was at the Palladium, the very first place I came to Hollywood. And that's where I met Don Van Vliet, Captain Beefheart, at the second annual teen fair. And he was so out of place. He was... He didn't fit in. How he got that gig, I don't know, 1965. But he when Victor introduced us, he looked me up and down and said, "You're a gas. I wish there were more people like you." And I
was like, right.
Really? What is it about me? I was this high school kid. And for this giant, burly, so much of the stuff I've been through, it's hard to describe. But for him to recognize that, it's something in me there. It just shifted my whole, it sent me on a whole other path.
Wonderful, wonderful. So, Pamela, while all this was going on, there was a kind of another LA happening that you semi-intersected with, but it's very different from the sort of Rodney's GTO's LA. The sort of, I'm talking about the kind of laid-back singer-songwriter crowd exemplified by kind of Joni Mitchell and Jackson Browne and so forth. It just so happens that, next week sees the UK publication of producer Peter Asher's memoir, A Life in Music. So we decided to digitize an interview that I did with him in 2003. And you know, given that his biggest success came with Linda Ronstadt, I thought it'd be interesting to look at sort of the parallels between, you know, her experience as a female musician, particularly in LA, and your own take on what it meant to be a woman in that era, in that city. The audio quality isn't exceptional, but let's hear the first clip and maybe discuss that.
I mean, what's undoubtedly true is what they say, you know, from people to another, the woman who makes a fuss is difficult, the man who makes a fuss is determined.
Yeah.
That was undoubtedly true. Linda's reputation for being difficult is 90% generated by just simply knowing what you want and trying to get it, you know. I didn't find it difficult at all.
No.
And probably because I listened to her, you know, and I respected her.
Well, she said, I'm unwilling to hear, she said, you know, that you were the first man who treated her like an equal.
Right. It's weird. I never think of myself as a, you know, pre-feminist, but it didn't occur to me to do anything different. Yeah.
No.
So, you know, I thought it's interesting maybe for you to hear someone like Linda Ronstadt talking in that era and the sort of struggle she had with men domineering kind of producers and record executives and boyfriends, of course, you know. And, you know, I always did get the impression that Peter was a very sympathetic kind of guy. What did you think of all that music that was made? You know, the Canyon sound, the singer-songwriters. You know, did you feel you were in a very sort of different LA sphere from those people? I mean,
no, we were all in
it was all one
Canyon
thing.
Together. Yeah. And I revered her. She was my favorite singer. I saw her play
was she?
Many times at the Troubadour. I was always inspired by her and vice versa. She writes about me in her book in a really positive, sweet way. You know, we'd interact in the office. I guess she was managed by Herb Cohen or something, because we were always together I'd see her in the office and I always got to go to her gigs for free because of our connection. And I just loved it. I never paid for a gig probably my whole life. I mean, back then I just walked in, but anyway, I loved her. I loved her and I loved Crosby, Stills, and Nash. The first time I heard Crosby, Stills, and Nash, pretty young, I was living with Brandon downstairs. David Crosby lived upstairs. And I'd visit with him sometimes. He never had clothes on. He was always naked in the house. He had big bowls of Coke and pot everywhere. I mean, he was very accommodating. That's a word for it. But one day I went up there looking for Brandon and he said, here, I want to play you something. And he had this bunch of equipment there and he turned it on, played some amazing music. I'd never heard anything like it. And he said, this is my new group. We're going to call ourselves the Frozen Noses.
I can't think why.
Even then I thought, that's not a very good name for a band. and it's a bust also. So I thought, well, that's not cool. But anyway, the music was amazing. And of course, decided not to call it that, but use their real names for the music. Yeah. So I've often said I was the Forrest Gump of a lot of stuff because I was in situations that no one would believe. So I wrote about it. And, you know, I still get many detractors. I still get people saying to me that you're making this up. A lot of people think I made a bunch of it up. Not true. It's all there. It's all in my diaries. And they should be in the Smithsonian or something. Not the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, because I'm not a fan of that. But, you know, their history from a very important time frame, musically especially, but not just music. It was culturally, sexually, politically. I mean, it was all there. It was this the height. It was all came together in like 66 to 74 ish. Those are the years that I think all that shit went down. And it started shifting after Manson and Altamont and stuff, but it was still intact. For a lot of people say, you know, that's when it all ended, but that's not true. It kept going for a while. When the hard drugs came on, coke especially, what a nightmare that stuff is. You know, when we were on acid and smoking a lot of pot and looking for God in everything and each other, it was nothing like it.
I mean, some of it's just too outrageous to have been made up. So, I mean, how can anyone think that if you were making it up, you'd have aimed a bit lower, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
I get called slut. I get called a slut on social media.
Oh, for goodness.
I'm a 74-year-old lady, right? Now, I still get called a slut. Is that a compliment? I don't know. My age, maybe it is.
Well, look, just to say a little more about the Peter Asher interview, I mean, revisiting it after two decades, it was pretty interesting to hear. You know, he's a very bright guy.
Yes.
Obviously, he's a fellow countryman of ours. He first went to America as one half of Peter and Gordon, had, you know, pop success in America, was on the Sunset Strip, probably the same time as you.
We interacted.
Yeah. Okay. But then he goes back to London, works for Apple, obviously. Jane Asher was his sister. Jane was Paul McCartney's girlfriend. Anyway, and then he comes back to LA with James Taylor, who'd been signed to Apple. And so he talks in this audio interview quite a lot about James Taylor and making the Sweet Baby James album, which I think is a real seminal sort of LA album from the late 60s. Is it 69-70? Anyway, I really like that record. I have to say, you weren't allowed even to say you like James Taylor in the kind of punk era, but I've come around to it now. So, and he talks about Carole King and Tapestry, You've Got a Friend, and all of that. So it's an interesting sort of British perspective, if you like, almost on that whole LA era, the singer-songwriters. Another artist that he produced was John David or J.D. Souther, who co-wrote more than a few of the great Eagles songs and who, of course, had relationships with more than a few female singers in LA. He was a real heartbreaker and lady killer, I think.
He was a ladies
man. I only interacted
with him with Chris Hillman when I saw Souther.
Oh, okay. Of course, Souther, Hillman, Fuhrer. Yeah, because I think Chris was your first sort of real love, wasn't he? Yeah.
Yes.
So I'd forgotten that you had that connection too. Well, let's hear the second clip from the Peter Asher audio where he talks about JD.
John never had a working memory.
Yeah.
There was not a girl singer who ever set foot in Los Angeles in that era. John David did not have a Nellie.
That's the impression I get.
No, it's true.
I broke a few hearts.
There's a very funny story that you'd have to get from one of them to tell. There was a point in time when Jody and Linda met on the doorstep. One leaving, one arriving, and realized what was going on.
That had to happen at some point. Let's face it.
Yeah. Exactly.
You could do a Pete Frame family tree just with their relationship.
Exactly.
Well, I love that idea of, you know, who was leaving, who was arriving.
Yeah.
Peter didn't say and maybe doesn't know. Anyway, maybe it was Joni leaving and Linda arriving or the other way around. But it's a great moment in sort of L.A. Canyon history.
Very Laurel Canyon. You know, I do these rock and roll tours. I'm with the band Rock and Roll Tours, where I take people around in a big van and show them all the sites where all this stuff happened, where the GTOs did their record, where the Zappas moved to, you know, where all the birds lived, where love lived. And I also go by Joni Mitchell's house because everyone wants to know where that, you know, our house is a very, very, very fine house, where that is.
Our house is a very, very, very fine house with two cats in the yard. Life used to be so hard.
Apparently she still owns that house and just leases it, but yeah, so that's definitely part of my thing. I definitely have to go by there because everyone wants to know where it was. It was right above where Frank Zappa lived.
Does the bus go up to Appian Way where Carole King's house was?
No, I don't go up there. I haven't had much call.
Too high.
I haven't had much call for Carole King people in my band.
I admire
all the women who came through there. I mean, it wasn't easy for them.
No, absolutely. Well, listen, it's been absolutely fabulous talking to you about that LA era. As I mentioned at the beginning, Jeff Beck and Rod Stewart showed up during the Permanent Damage sessions, if I've got that correct.
The whole
Jeff Beck group,
yep,
showed up, which is an amazing, well, it's an amazing and I guess kind of, you know, poignant coincidence, given that we learned late yesterday that Jeff Beck had died very suddenly after contracting, he'd gone meningitis, bacterial meningitis. Yeah. So, he was 78, which is, you know, I mean, it's not young, but no one imagined he was about to leave us. So, Mark, I'm going to ask you what your first memory of hearing or being aware of Jeff Beck, you know, as a player, as a rock and roll, as a pop star.
They're two different things. I mean, yeah. as a pop star, there's kind of that, I have to say, ghastly Hi-Ho Silver Lining, which is a song that I'd condemn, you know, happily. I guess it was kind of like blow by blow around there where I really started hearing
Not the Yardbirds.
No, but it was too, they were before my time. I know it's ridiculous, like, you know, just... You know, when you're that age, if it's 3 years before your time, it's, you know, it's dead. Then I just love his playing. I don't necessarily love the music he's playing in terms of its sort of general format. I mean, I've got a fairly low tolerance of kind of fusac, you know, kind of jazz, funk, fusion sort of stuff, you know. But he is an extraordinary player. I mean, Jimi Hendrix is my great god as a guitar player. And Beck's like the next best thing, the guy who could really tell stories on the guitar. And I love that 2007, that run of gigs he did at Ronnie Scott's, which, you know, you can hear and see the album's released, the videos, the DVDs out there. And he's just extraordinary. The other thing that was fantastic about him is that he actively employed women musicians.
Yeah.
Fabulous. I mean, that bass player, Tal...
Wilkenfeld.
Yeah, yeah. Just astonishing. And you know, he comes from that sort of like macho kind of rock and roll culture. And for him to absolutely throw the doors open of his band to women musicians, I thought was fantastic. So it didn't matter the context. His playing was always astonishing, regardless of the context. I mean, Barney, you really like his version of Ness and Dorma, don't you?
Yeah, I saw him play that Ness and Dorma live at this open air festival in Surrey once. And I have to say, part of me just thought this is just so naff and absurd.
Yeah, yeah.
But 5-6 minutes later, I had tears streaming down my face. I mean, it was so beautiful. My heart was just kind of bursting with the beauty of his playing. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, and I remember when we were first starting Rock's Back Pages, so 20 years ago, your place in Clapham Common West Side, you playing Brush with the Blues, and both of us just fantastic.
Oh my God, yeah.
I mean, the only thing is, he used to play with his fingers. He didn't use a pick, certainly for his latter period. And that his touch was just, you know, beyond
so
belief.
So human, really. So yeah. I mean, just the humanity of the guy. Pamela, do you remember when you first were aware of Jeff? I guess it would have been in the Yardbirds. Did you see them in kind of the mid-60s?
No, I didn't meet Jeff or know much about him until the Jeff Beck group.
Right.
They came to town. We were always wanting to be with him. Whoever British band came to town.
Any British band would do.
Pretty much. But none of us got with them. Sexually or anything, people misconstrue the term groupie because a lot of times we just wanted to spend time with these people, hang out, know them, share stuff. And, you know, we took them all shopping. We took them to our favorite vintage store, the only vintage clothing store in LA at the time, with Glass Farmhouse, took the whole band there and they got decked out on stuff. I remember Rod bought probably his first feather boa there. I mean,
wow, that's great.
And we'd sat at the Chateau Marmont with him all afternoon watching soccer. It was that kind of thing. And we all got along really well, and they wanted to play on our record. Frank asked them. I guess Jeff was a big fan of Frank's and vice versa. And Frank asked them to be on the record, and they came down, spent a whole day there with us in the studio. And it was so thrilling.
Yeah.
It was hard to express how thrilling it was for us all. And he played on three songs. I think the Eureka Springs Garbage Lady he's got some really good stuff on.
Okay, so he's on. I was going to ask you, it's not immediately obvious where Beck is playing on the record.
Oh, I wasn't sure how much stuff. I think
you think it's. I have to go listen a little more closely.
It's very obvious what he's playing.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
Frank turned him way up. And Rod Stewart was such a, you know, he wasn't getting enough attention. We called him Rodney Rooster then because his hair stuck straight up.
Yes.
Rodney is what we called him. But he disappeared at one point because he wasn't getting enough attention. And we had to go out looking for him in the middle of Glendale, you know, suburb. And finally found him sitting on the steps of a school sulking. And, you know, we had to bring him back and get him on a song, right? So he sings on Mercy's song, Mercy's crazy song at the end of the album. And you can hear him just screaming, shock treatment, oh, let me go. Shock Treatment.
Wow.
Is the name of that song. It's very Mercy.
I'm gonna have to go and listen to the record again with slightly better headphones, I think. Please let me go. We're marking Jeff Beck's passing. I mean, I do feel, you know, really, really sad, actually.
Yeah.
But we've got some great stuff on Jeff Beck, including an audio interview that a guy called Steve Newton did in 2001. So you'll be able to hear Jeff talking to him. I mean, it's a phone interview, but it's interesting. And there's three interviews, one from when Jeff was a Yardbird, actually from KRLA Beat. So wow. It's got that kind of LA context.
My I think
the Yardbirds must have been. Yeah, exactly. So he's talking about being a Yardbird. There's actually an interview that Alan Light, former Vibe editor, sent me this morning, which has got great quotes about how Stevie Wonder's Superstition came together, which is just great. And also the wonderful Kate Mossman, who was a guest on our podcast last year, wrote a fabulous profile of Jeff in 2016 for the New Statesman. And I'm just going to quote this because it sort of speaks to what we were saying earlier, just about the unique sound of Jeff's playing. Much of what Jeff has done with his instrument resulted from a kind of musical mechanics, a private process of tinkering, test driving, and refinement. Years ago, while listening to Bulgarian choral music, presumably because he couldn't bear to listen to guitars, he started playing a tune with his tremolo. Pulling the whammy bar high off the body, he divined notes from an invisible scale in midair. The ghost voice, more like a theremin than a strat, appears on the 1989 song Where Were You, which I think is also one of the most supernaturally beautiful things Jeff ever did. And I just think that's just an interesting thing to learn from Kate's fabulous piece, actually. I mean, she's clearly a fan. You really expect to read a long piece about Jeff Beck in the New Statesman, but there it is. The title is The 7 Million Pound Fingers, How Jeff Beck Became a Guitar Hero by Saying No.
It's a great piece.
It's a wonderful piece. And I mean, I you know, people always said that he was the inspiration for Nigel Tufnell, and one can kind of see that in Smile Time. He is quite, the Tufnell character is quite Beckish, but it's just another thing that made me love Jeff Beck, you know. And I mean, I agree with you, Mark. I think next to Hendrix, he's the most extraordinary electric guitar player
that
rock has ever produced. So farewell. Do you guys have any pieces you want to just briefly mention before we wrap up?
Actually, really, just one piece I'd particularly like to mention, which is, well, I'd like to mention as an aside, we've got our first Ethel Merman piece on the site, which has given me great pleasure. But this is Bonnie Raitt, interviewed by Judith Sims, Rolling Stone, November 72, about going to Woodstock to record Taking My Time, I think. I could be wrong about which album it was. And she says, in June, there aren't many places that are pleasant. So I thought, Woodstock, out in the country, right? Dramatic pause, sly smile. It rained every day. My house had frogs and salamanders, grimaced. Freezing, no heat, I got sick. And Woodstock, for all its musical reputation, is no place for a girl who likes to have her fun. The town's real incestuous. The old ladies dress up in low-cut slinky dresses and paint their eyes and sit around in the one restaurant, bored stiff because their old men are never there. They're either on the road or in a studio or driving down the main street picking up 15-year-old girls and heading out to the woods. Real decadence. The whole town's on the nod. Guys sit at the traffic lights waiting for the streets to turn green. I had to go back to New York City to get healthy. I just love that. I think that's fantastic.
That is so funny. I mean, it's basically the Sunset Strip with pine trees and snow, isn't it? just quickly as an aside, Pamela, is it true that Miss Christine went up to Woodstock with Todd Rundgren and also like had a fling with Albert Grossman?
Yes.
I'm very curious. That is true. All of that is true.
Yes,
that is extraordinary.
Yes, I remember meeting Albert Grossman at the Whiskey A Go-Go with her and thinking, wow, she's really going in different directions here.
Well, thanks for confirming.
We always respected each other, what we each other did. That was the thing about women back then. You know, we understood each other, and if we didn't, even that was okay. Like if she wanted to be with Albert Grossman, there was no judgment between any of us.
Mm-hmm. I just want to quote from another Judith Sims piece quickly, because I noticed it, Mark, you added this, I guess, sometime in the last couple of weeks. It's an interview from 1973 that Judith did with Carol Kaye, the great session bass player. It seems to kind of chime in with the general theme of this episode. She says, once you get past the woman's role, you've got it made. If you can forget you're a woman and think of yourself as a person, it comes off better. And I mean, I guess she's talking as a female session player surrounded mainly by male musicians.
In the same piece, she talks about sort of, you know, the few times where she'd lead a session, how weird it was as a woman to lead a session. And she had to be like a mother with these boys, you know.
Right.
And she would say, I would say, you know, I'd say shit just to make the guys feel comfortable.
That's all it took.
That's all
Jasper,
it took.
Have you got any pieces you want to tell
sure,
us about?
Sure, yeah, I'll just mention a couple of things. One of them actually kind of dovetails with what sort of the same thing as what you, the piece you just talked about, which is an interesting piece by Frances Morgan in The Wire. It's called Women's March. It's from May 2014. Mm-hmm. And they're looking at how compiling by gender can either be good and positive and productive as a way of kind of positively changing people's perceptions of any given genre, but can also reduce sonic horizons. And it's quite an academic piece, as you might expect from The Wire, but it's really worth reading, where Frances Morgan is arguing about, you know, how do you compile a compilation of women's music without ghettoizing women by doing that? And I think that's fascinating. And then the other thing is a live review of The Comet Is Coming by Ben Myers in Mojo in March 2017. And The Comet Is Coming, I mean, earlier we sort of touched on who's doing interesting, inventive music nowadays. I would say very firmly Shabaka Hutchins and The Comet Is Coming. Just an amazing, amazing group. And Ben Myers writes, though the trio's appearance on the Mercury Music Prize list prompted the obligatory token jazz entry grumblings, this sound is a million interplanetary miles away from the measured jazz of scholars. This is future-forward jazz, fixed with a charge and fuse, then detonated, a spectral shimmering display of pyrotechnics, bong-bubbling dub of journey through the asteroid belt to banging acid house and global hypercolor afro-punk via a limb-flailing, drum-led dance-off, which I think is a fantastic description of an incredible band.
Wonderful writing. It makes me want to hear the band.
Yeah, I think you'd like them. I think you'd like them, Pamela.
They're astonishingly good, actually. They really are.
Right. Well, thank you so much for that, Jasper. That brings us to the end of the episode, and it remains only for me to thank you so much for joining us today, Pamela. It's a real joy to hear you and go back in time through all those amazing memories. We will be back in 2 weeks with Gary Kemp, former Spandau Ballet man. Do visit Rock's Back Pages, where subscribers can read over 50,000 articles and over 800 audio interviews are also there. Check to see if your local library subscribes to RBP. If not, maybe suggest you take a free trial of the world's largest archive of music journalism. And it's bye from me and bye from you guys.
Bye.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
That concludes episode 144 of the Rock's Back Pages podcast. Many thanks to special guest Pamela Daybar. Visit her website at pameladaybarofficial.com for details of her podcast, books, and more. The host of Barney Hoskins and Mark Pringle, and it was co-hosted and produced by Jasper Murison Bowie. The Rock's Back Pages podcast is part of the Pantheon Podcast Network. You can find thousands of articles, as well as hundreds of full-length audio interviews, at rocksbackpages.com.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Frunino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.